ground, although it follows a straight line in three-dimensional space, its shadow follows a curved path on the two-dimensional ground. The mass of the sun curves space-time in such a way that although the Earth follows a straight path in four-dimensional space-time, it appears to us to move along a circular orbit in three-dimensional space. In fact, the orbits of the planets predicted by general relativity are almost exactly the same as those predicted by the Newtonian theory of gravity. However, in the case of Mercury, which being the nearest planet to the Sun, feels the strongest gravitational effects and has a rather elongated orbit, general relativity predicts that the long axis of the ellipse should rotate about the Sun at a rate of about 1 degree in 10,000 years. Small though this effect is, it had been noticed before 1915 and served as one of the first confirmations of Einstein's theory. In recent years, the even smaller deviations of the orbits of the other planets from the Newtonian predictions have been measured by radar and found to agree with the predictions of general relativity. Light rays, too, must follow geodesics in space-time. Again, the fact that space is curved means that light no longer appears to travel in straight lines in space. So general relativity predicts that light should be bent by gravitational fields. For example, the theory predicts that the light cones of points near the Sun will be slightly bent inward on account of the mass of the Sun. This means that light from a distant star that happened to pass near the Sun would be deflected through a small angle, causing the star to appear in a different position to an observer on the Earth. Of course, if the light from the star always passed close to the Sun, we would not be able to tell whether the light was being deflected or if instead the star was really where we see it. However, as the Earth orbits around the Sun, different stars appear to pass behind the Sun and have their light deflected. They therefore change their apparent position relative to other stars. It is normally very difficult to see this effect, because the light from the Sun makes it impossible to observe stars that appear near to the Sun in the sky. However, it is possible to do so during an eclipse of the Sun when the Sun's light is blocked out by the Moon. Einstein's prediction of light deflection could not be tested immediately in 1915 because the First World War was in progress, and it wasn't until 1919 that a British expedition observing an eclipse from West Africa showed that light was indeed deflected by the Sun, just as predicted by the theory. This proof of a German theory by British scientists was hailed as a great act of reconciliation between the two countries after the war. It is ironic, therefore, that later examination of the photographs taken on that expedition showed the errors were as great as the effect they were trying to measure. Their measurement had been sheer luck, or a case of knowing the result they wanted to get, not an uncommon occurrence in science. The light deflection has, however, been accurately confirmed by a number of later observations. Another prediction of general relativity is that time should appear to run slower near a massive body like the Earth. This is because there is a relation between the energy of light and its frequency, that is, the number of waves of light per second. The greater the energy, the higher the frequency. As light travels upward in the Earth's gravitational field, it loses energy, and so its frequency goes down. This means that the length of time between one wave crest and the next goes up. To someone high up, it would appear that everything below, down below, was taking longer to happen. This prediction was tested in 1962 using a pair of very accurate clocks mounted at the top and bottom of a water tower. The clock at the bottom, which was nearer the Earth, was found to run slower in exact agreement with general relativity. The difference in the speed of clocks at different heights above the Earth is now of considerable practical importance with the advent of the very accurate navigation systems based on signals from satellites. If one ignored the predictions of general relativity, the position that one calculated would be wrong by several miles. Newton's laws of motion put an end to the idea of absolute position in space. The theory of relativity gets rid of absolute time. Consider a pair of twins, Suppose that one twin goes to live on the top of a mountain while the other stays at sea level. The first twin would age faster than the second. Thus, if they met again, one would be older than the other. In this case, the difference in ages would be very small, but it would be much larger if one of the twins went for a long trip in a spaceship at nearly the speed of light. When he returned, he would be much younger than the one who stayed on Earth. This is known as the twins' paradox, but it is a paradox only if one has the idea of absolute time at the back of one's mind. In the theory of relativity, there is no unique absolute time, but instead, each individual has his own personal measure of time that depends on where he is and how he is moving. Before 1915, space and time were thought of as a fixed arena in which events took place, but which was not affected by what happened in it. This was true even of the special theory of relativity. Bodies moved, forces attracted and repelled, but time and space simply continued unaffected. It was natural to think that space and time went on forever. The situation, however, is quite different in the general theory of relativity. Space and time are now dynamic quantities. When a body moves or a force acts, it affects the curvature of space and time, and in turn the structure of space-time affects the way in which bodies move and forces act. Space and time not only affect, but also are affected by everything that happens in the universe. Just as one cannot talk about events in the universe without the notions of space and time, so in general relativity, it became meaningless to talk about space and time outside the limits of the universe. In the following decades, this new understanding of space and time was to revolutionize our view of the universe. The old idea of an essentially unchanging universe that could have existed and could continue to exist forever was replaced by the notion of a dynamic, expanding universe that seemed to have begun a finite time ago, and that might end at a finite time in the future. That revolution forms the subject of the next chapter, and years later, it was also to be the starting point for my work in theoretical physics. Roger Penrose and I showed that Einstein's general theory of relativity implied that the universe must have a beginning and possibly an end. Chapter 3, The Expanding Universe. If one looks at the sky on a clear moonless night, the brightest objects one sees are likely to be the planets Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. There will also be a very large number of stars, which are just like our own sun, but much farther from us. Some of these fixed stars do in fact appear to change very slightly their positions relative to each other as the Earth orbits around the sun. They're not really fixed at all. This is because they are comparatively near to us. As the Earth goes round the sun, we see them from different positions against the background of more distant stars. Now, this is fortunate because it enables us to measure directly the distance of these stars from us. The nearer they are, the more they appear to move. The nearest star, called Proxima Centauri, is found to be about 4 light years away. The light from it takes about 4 years to reach Earth, or about 23 million million miles. Most of the other stars that are visible to the naked eye lie within a few hundred light years of us. Our sun, for comparison, is a mere 8 light minutes away. The visible stars appear spread all over the night sky, but are particularly concentrated in one band, which we call the Milky Way. As long ago as 1750, some astronomers were suggesting that the appearance of the Milky Way could be explained if most of the visible stars lie in a single disc-like configuration, one example of which we now call a spiral galaxy. Only a few decades later, the astronomer Sir William Herschel confirmed his idea by painstakingly cataloging and positioning the distances of vast number of stars. Even so, the idea gained complete acceptance only early this century. Our modern picture of the universe dates back to only 1924, when the American astronomer Edwin Hubble demonstrated that ours was not the only galaxy. There were, in fact, many others with vast tracts of empty space between them. In order to prove this, he needed to determine the distances to these other galaxies, which are so far away that, unlike nearby stars, they really do appear fixed. Hubble was forced, therefore, to use indirect methods to measure the distances. Now the apparent brightness of a star depends on two factors: how much light it radiates, that's its luminosity, and how far it is from us. For nearby stars, we can measure their apparent brightness and their distance, and so we can work out their luminosity. Conversely, if we knew the luminosity of stars in other galaxies, we could work out their distance by measuring their apparent brightness. Hubble noted that certain types of stars always have the same luminosity when they are near enough for us to measure. Therefore, he argued, if we found such stars in another galaxy, we could assume that they had the same luminosity, and so calculate the distance to that galaxy. If we could do this for a number of stars in the same galaxy, and our calculations always gave the same distance, we could be fairly confident of our estimate. In this way, Edwin Hubble worked out the distances to 9 different galaxies. We now know that our galaxy is only one of some 100,000 million that can be seen using modern telescopes, each galaxy itself containing some 100,000 million stars. We live in a galaxy that is about 100,000 light years across and is slowly rotating. The stars, in its spiral arms, orbit around its center about once every several 100 million years. Our Sun is just an ordinary, average-sized yellow star near the inner edge of one of the spiral arms. We have certainly come a long way since Aristotle and Ptolemy, when we thought that the Earth was the center of the universe. Stars are so far away that they appear to us to be just pinpoints of light. We can't see their size or shape, so how can we tell different types of stars apart? Well, for the vast majority of stars, there's only one characteristic feature that we can observe: the color of their light. Newton discovered that if light from the Sun passes through a triangular-shaped piece of glass called a prism, it breaks up into its component colors, its spectrum, as in a rainbow. By focusing a telescope on an individual star or galaxy, one can similarly observe the spectrum of the light from the star or galaxy. Different stars have different spectra, but the relative brightness of the different colors is always exactly what one would expect to find in the light emitted by an object that is glowing red hot. In fact, the light emitted by an opaque object that is glowing red hot has a characteristic spectrum that depends only on its temperature, a thermal spectrum. This means that we can tell a star's temperature from the spectrum of its light. Moreover, we find that certain very specific colors are missing from star spectra, and these missing colors may vary from star to star. Since we know that each chemical element absorbs a characteristic set of very specific colors, by matching these to those that are missing from a star's spectrum, we can determine exactly which elements are present in the star's atmosphere. In the 1920s, when astronomers began to look at the spectra of stars in other galaxies, they found something most peculiar. There were the same characteristic set of missing colors as for stars in our own galaxy, but they were all shifted by the same relative amount toward the red end of the spectrum. Now, to understand the implications of this, we must first understand the Doppler effect. As we have seen, visible light consists of fluctuations or waves in the electromagnetic field. The frequency, or number of waves per second, of light is extremely high, ranging from 400 to 700 million waves per second. The different frequencies of light are what the human eye sees as different colors, with the lowest frequencies appearing at the red end of the spectrum and the highest frequencies at the blue end. Now imagine a source of light at a constant distance from us, such as a star, emitting waves of light at a constant frequency. Obviously, the frequency of the waves we receive will be the same as the frequency at which they are emitted. The gravitational field of the galaxy will not be large enough to have a significant effect. Suppose now that the source starts moving toward us. When the source emits the next wave crest, it will be nearer to us. So the time that wave crest takes to reach us will be less than when the star was stationary. This means that the time between the two wave crests reaching us is smaller, and therefore the number of waves we receive each second, in other words, the frequency, is higher than when the star was stationary. Correspondingly, if the source is moving away from us, the frequency of the waves we receive will be lower. In the case of light, therefore, this means that stars moving away from us will have their spectra shifted toward the red end of the spectrum, redshifted, and those moving toward us will have their spectra blue-shifted. This relationship between frequency and speed, which is called the Doppler effect, is an everyday experience. Listen to a car passing on the road. As the car is approaching, its engine sounds at a higher pitch, corresponding to a higher frequency of sound waves. And when it passes and goes away, it sounds at a lower pitch. The behavior of light or radio waves is similar. Indeed, the police make use of the Doppler effect to measure the speed of cars by measuring the frequency of pulses of radio waves reflected off them. In the years following his proof of the existence of other galaxies, Hubble spent his time cataloging their distances and observing their spectra. At that time, most people expected the galaxies to be moving around quite randomly and so expected to find as many blue-shifted spectra as red-shifted ones. It was quite a surprise, therefore, to find that most galaxies appeared red-shifted. Nearly all were moving away from us. More surprising still was the finding that Hubble published in 1929. Even the size of a galaxy's redshift is not random, but is directly proportional to the galaxy's distance from us. Or in other words, the farther a galaxy is, the farther and faster it is moving away. And that meant that the universe could not be static, as everyone previously had thought, but is in fact expanding. The distance between the different galaxies is growing all the time. The discovery that the universe is expanding was one of the great intellectual revolutions of the 20th century. With hindsight, it is easy to wonder why no one had thought of it before. Newton and others should have realized that a static universe would soon start to contract under the influence of gravity. But suppose instead the universe expanding. If it were expanding fairly slowly, the force of gravity would cause it eventually to stop expanding and then to start contracting. However, if it was expanding at more than a certain critical rate, gravity would never be strong enough to stop it, and the universe would continue to expand forever. This is a bit like what happens when one fires a rocket upward from the surface of the Earth. If it has a fairly low speed, gravity will eventually stop the rocket, and it will start falling back. On the other hand, if the rocket has more than a certain critical speed, about 7 miles per second, gravity will not be strong enough to pull it back. So it will keep going away from the Earth forever. This behavior of the universe could have been predicted from Newton's theory of gravity at any time in the 19th, the 18th, or even the late 17th centuries. Yet so strong was the belief in a static universe that it persisted into the early 20th century. Even Einstein, when he formulated the general theory of relativity in 1915, was so sure that the universe had to be static that he modified his theory to make this possible, introducing a so-called cosmological constant into his equations. Einstein introduced a new anti-gravity force, which, unlike other forces, did not come from any particular source, but was built into the very fabric of space-time. He claimed that space-time had an inbuilt tendency to expand, and this could be made to balance exactly the attraction of all matter in the universe so that a static universe would result. Only one man, it seems, was willing to take general relativity at face value, and while Einstein and other physicists were looking for ways of avoiding general relativity's prediction of a non-static universe, the Russian physicist and mathematician Alexander Friedmann instead set about explaining it. Friedmann made two very simple assumptions about the universe: that the universe looks identical in whichever direction we look, and that this would also be true if we were observing the universe from anywhere else. From these two ideas alone, Friedmann showed that we should not expect the universe to be static. In fact, in 1922, several years before Edwin Hubble's discovery, Friedmann predicted exactly what Hubble found. the assumption that the universe looks the same in every direction.